From the Sky News Centre at 5, 9 out of 12 journalists awaiting trial or retrial under Operation Elvedon are being told their cases won't go ahead. It follows the acquittal of several reporters this afternoon. Nick Qureshi reports.
Joy as they walked free from court, but anger they'd been sent for trial in the first place. Graham Brough was the first Mirror reporter to be tried under Operation Elvedon.
I am greatly relieved that professional reporters have not been criminalised today.
The three others cleared today of paying public officials for stories include The Sun's Neil Millard.
Just won back what I thought was mine in the first place, my reputation, my job, my life, my dignity.
A jury deliberated for more than 40 hours before returning not guilty verdicts on the men who'd been accused of bribing prison guards for inside information about high-profile inmates.
Merseyside police have started a murder investigation after two women were found dead in Bootle. Their bodies were discovered at separate addresses last night. Plaid Cymru's Leanne Wood claims Ed Miliband has left the door open for another Tory government. She says it's disappointing to hear him refuse to commit to an emergency budget that would reverse Conservative spending cuts. The mother of a newborn baby girl found abandoned in a toilet block in Southport yesterday has been traced. Police say she's receiving medical treatment. The baby's said to be safe and well. Rolls-Royce has announced its largest ever order, worth more than £6 billion. Emirates has chosen the British-made engines to power some of its new super jumbos. Rolls-Royce chief executive John Rishton says it's a significant deal.
Over 200 engines to power their 50 A380s is a terrific order and reflects the huge amount of work, hard work, that many, many people in Rolls-Royce have done to win this order. It's really a great day for us.
And in sport, James Anderson has equalled Sir Ian Botham's record as England's all-time leading test wicket taker. He's on 383 after claiming another victim in the first test in the West Indies. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Martin Fodor for the Green Party, Christian Martin for the Liberal Democrats, and Hibak Jama for Labour. You may remember we had the UK Independence Party and the Conservatives on last week. Well, only actually the UK Independence Party, because the Conservatives did not put up a local councillor, even though they were given 3 or 4 days notice. So this week it's the other three main parties. After the 6 o'clock news, the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme in 1986 still hangs in the air as a blot on the record of Europe and Scandinavia. We speak to Ole Damgaard, who's written a book, Coup d'etat in slow motion, about Sweden and about the killing of the Prime Minister. Also, next weekend, Richard Gage from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth is in Bristol, and we're joined by one of Martin Summers' colleagues from Reinvestigate 9/11, Ian Henshaw, who's written a book, Reinvestigating 9/11. We'll be talking about news on the Saudi connections to 2001's 9/11 attacks, the misreporting of which marks one of the greatest ever failings in the history of Britain's mainstream media. And investigative journalism. Following on from our debate a few weeks ago, I managed to track down one of the main researchers on the TV programme that many believe spelled the end of investigative journalism in Britain, on television anyway, a 1988 ITV documentary into the apparent execution of IRA suspects in Gibraltar by the SAS. Alison Kahn tells us about the making of Death on the Rock and gives us her thoughts on what Britain lost when the Thatcher government began closing down on what was then a thriving industry in investigative journalism. plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. So helping us review this week's news, it's Martin Foda for the Green Party, Christian Martin for the Liberal Democrats, and Hibak Jarma for Labour. Hello, all of you, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good afternoon, Tony.
I think we might start, and I'll ask you all the same thing, really, which is about whether you think this election is going to be, I'm talking about in the city or the general election, whichever you wish, whether you think it's going to be different to previous ones, and whether there's going to be any kind of real difference, because I know right across the city there's a lot of people out there thinking, well, what's the point in voting? Because what we get is really the ship is still going the wrong way, whichever way we vote. Let's start with you, Hibak.
Yes, I think this election is certainly one to be remembered. Because for the first time, it's probably the election that will be very, very difficult to call. And whoever wins, it's likely that no one will win by an overwhelming majority. So it's certainly one to watch.
What would you say to anyone who's saying, well, why should I vote? What's the point? Because the whole edifice, the whole country really is just going on in the same way, the wrong way.
Well, we in the Labour Party have been doing an awful lot of work to engage marginalised communities and make sure that they understand the power that their vote has. We've registered an awful lot of people to vote, and we've tried our best in different languages to set out what Labour's policies are, what Labour's plan for Bristol and this country is. And I think, you know, that's as far as you can go with politics. Once that's done, people have to sit back and make their decision for themselves as to who can lead them.
Christian, what do you think is going to characterise this election? Is it going to be any different to previous ones?
Well, obviously it's different because the polls are predicting that the outcome is going to still result in a hung parliament.
But the premise you
just put to Hipak, though, about how this differs from previous elections, yeah, you know, and what we're looking forward to, is that we have just had a coalition government. We're just coming to the end of a coalition government. That is a different form of government to any government that we've had for a long, long time in this country. So the landscape changed, and in that change, we saw certain policies and ideas coming from a different party, my party, being put into practice in government.
OK, so here's your chance. Tell us what difference you've really made over the last 5 years being in coalition with the Conservatives.
Well, I think Nick and the various other leaders in my party and members from the Cabinet point out that, you know, the Labour Party would take us to left and the Conservative Party would take us to right, and we take the centre ground, and that's exactly what we did in government. We acted as a brake on certain policies
of
Conservatives.
Which policies specifically?
Well, the Conservatives would have liked to have cut welfare considerably more than they already have. So they would have cut deeper and harder, and we put a brake on that, and I think that's a significant achievement. You know, at the same time, we created a certain amount of fairness. They would not have gone along with marriage equality. They would not have gone along with the increase in the tax-free allowance to £10,500, which is now, you know, going up again. So things like that, pupil premium. I mean, the list is, there's a significant number of things. 75% of what we put into the coalition agreement has been enacted in government. That's a pretty good achievement in my book.
Martin Fodor, I can only see you. You're quite low down over there. But can you tell us, give us your thoughts on what makes this election different to the rest?
Yeah, I think it is a different election. And certainly in my experience, people are quite excited about the prospect for some sort of change and the possibility for not having business as usual, which all the major traditional parties are still offering, and the fact that the Green Party has risen considerably, both nationally and considerable amount locally. We're now the biggest political party in Bristol.
Yeah, but the balloon burst on your surge, didn't it? I mean, the surge has fallen to 4% poll ratings.
Christian,
now.
Don't interrupt me. I didn't interrupt you.
But you're not telling the truth, though, Martin, are you?
The BBC have confirmed that the Green Party is now the biggest party in Bristol. It's the biggest party in Bristol
West.
That's
members, but not council.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's membership. And membership, and the fact that it's still going up, and nationally it's just topped 60,000, which it's still rising. So it's now the third party in England. That makes it really interesting. And as a non-austerity party, there's actually finally a choice compared to the other parties.
Why hasn't the Green Party been able to translate the high membership that they've got into mm-hmm. actually political representation? Why not?
Well, actually, I think we are about to. Hopefully we'll be getting our second MP in Parliament to join Caroline Lucas, with Darren Hall in Bristol West sort of vying against the prospect of more from Labour. And we our membership has mainly risen in the last 12 months because people were so fed up with the idea that our agenda was being excluded from TV debates,
okay, for
instance.
Let's hear some practical stuff now, starting with you this time, Christian Martin from the Lib Dems. What are you going to do about the police? Because we've seen quite a serious fall in numbers of the police and cuts, despite the fact that you've been batting apparently up in Westminster for them, to our police force. So what is your policy and what are you going to do about falling police numbers? So I don't think anybody wants to see less police around to do their job, particularly when we've got what's happened since the Jimmy Savile scandal is that lots more people have been reporting very serious crimes to do with child sexual abuse. So what's your policing policy and what are you going to do about it?
I'm struggling, sorry Tony, to understand the conflation between the child sex abuse and police numbers. Well, the police are doing a considerable amount of work on police, tackling the investigations into that, and I personally have had some experience of that recently with the police, so I know how hard it is that they're working. But I think you're missing the point that Martin was making about the Greens being an anti-austerity party. You know, the question is, how are they going to pay for everything? No one ever asks them that question.
You'd like to hear them.
But you never ask them that question. You know, the Liberal Democrats have worked hard over the last 5 years to put money back into the bank. And if you are now proposing, Martin, that you're coming in as an anti-austerity party to then take all that money out of the bank and squander then this country cannot afford to do that, and you need to have a reality check and wake up.
Christian, can you answer the question, though, about the police? Well, how are you going to stop the falling numbers of police?
The falling numbers of police? Obviously, the police force is doing a fantastic job under trying circumstances. Everybody has had to look at ways in which they can implement savings where previously there was potentially waste. I believe that the police are still capable and able of doing the job that they're doing.
Well, why are the police federation locally saying that the force is being decimated then?
I have no comment to make on that because I've not seen the article you're talking about. I don't believe that's the case.
Well, it's a statement from Kevin Phillips from Avon and Somerset Police Federation. I mean, that's what the police federation is saying.
We have a police and crime commissioner, given to us by the Conservative government. So why don't you ask her? You know, it's a Conservative policy.
Martin, can you give us your views on the police? What will the Greens be doing with the police to stop the falling numbers?
That's right.
We've got 600 less police in Avon and Somerset now.
Yeah, I didn't know the exact number, but it's shocking. I mean, basically, there's one manifesto that's not promising to continue cutting local government and public services, and local government includes the precept for the police and fire services, and that's the Green Party. We won't be cutting local government. All the other parties will be.
Tony, there is a misnomer here. In our council tax bill, there is a precept. Yes. It went up again this year, and we contributed to the police. Now, that is not a cut, the government, Martin. We put more money in through our council tax bill.
Funnily enough, Christian, in local government, I certainly know, maybe you don't, that the majority of the funding comes from central government.
Well, of course
and
it
that's
does.
Been cut.
Okay. Because so how are you going to pay for it?
Because the austerity parties want to cut that.
Can you let me ask the questions, please, Christian? You're being a little bit over the top here.
Tony, we came along this afternoon to talk about the news. We were not informed that there were going to be other people from other parties.
I'm happy to have interrupt the rest
no,
of us.
But I'm happy to have a conversation about it, but let's ask the question, how are you going to pay for these anti-austerity measures that
you're
espousing?
Can you just explain how the Green Party is going to pay for this, though? It's all very well. Anybody can sit here and say, oh, we're going to pay for this, we're going to pay for that.
That's right, of course. Well, our manifesto is, as always, fully costed, and one of the big items that I could mention is the $100 billion that won't be spent on Trident. That's the four nuclear submarines, their replacement and their maintenance and their decommissioning, all of which are being committed to by at least two parties and then another nuclear program by another.
Okay.
So that's quite a substantial availability.
Okay.
And in addition, we won't cut tax for people who are actually quite comfortably off. The economy is now bigger than it was 5 years ago. The governing parties are actually crowing about that. But what they're still doing is cutting public services because they're transferring that wealth to others.
Okay. Thanks very much. Now, Hibbert, your turn. We've got 600 less police in Avon and Somerset than we had 5 years ago. How is Labour going to stop the decline?
Well, we would cut the office of the Police Crime Commissioner, which at the moment is costing us to the tune of 3 million. I think that 3 million can be spent in far better ways. I think there are far better, more economically sensible ways to hold the Chief Constable and Avon and Somerset to account without having an individual and an office that costs that much at a time when we're all facing austerity.
What would you say to those that say, well, the reason these police and crime commissioners were brought in was to bring some more democratic accountability to policing and to the way that the money that the public spends on policing is directed?
Well, in a time of austerity, you have to consider getting as much for your pound, and the truth is, if the aim here is to hold Avon and Somerset to account, there are far cleverer ways to do it without spending £3 million, and we can still have an elected individual or whatever it might be to play some sort of a role, but this whole area needs to be rethought, and a lot more money needs to be spent on frontline services and protecting our cops on the streets.
Now, I'm not sure if it's true or not, but there was a report a few weeks ago, March the 31st, saying that Bristol's the only major city in the UK where traffic congestion is easing. This was in the Bristol Post. Apparently, Bristol's had long had a reputation for being one of the most congested cities in the country. It appears there may be some light at the end of the tunnel for commuters. According to a national survey, the city has the sixth most congested streets in the UK. The research from TomTom has found traffic jams and delays are getting worse in most major cities, but not Bristol. Isn't that good news, Martin?
Well, it's excellent news. I mean, there are about 180 extra deaths a year in the city because of pollution, a lot of which comes from traffic. So it's good news if there's less traffic and less pollution.
But do you believe it?
I'm not convinced I've seen any evidence for that, but we know cycling has doubled in the city. We know bus ridership has gone up 20% in the last year. So there may well be people who are now not, for whatever reasons, could be economic, could be for health and fitness, could be because of parking issues, but they're now walking, cycling and using the bus or local rail, and those are all very good things.
Hibak, do you believe that the traffic levels are going down, and do you think we've got decent transport here in the city?
I could say no to both of those questions. I would just add that at the current level at which we are operating, we can do an awful lot better than that, and it starts with getting the transport system in place, an appropriate one, an affordable one, and it's also about encouraging people out of their cars, but that's the key word. It's encouraging, it's educating, and it's doing it with people rather than to people. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to bring it up, but the residence parking zone has had a huge campaign, and the idea behind that is having cleaner air and children living longer. And the truth is, again, it's not the way you do it. It's not what you do, it's the way you do it. And so we can do a lot better, but we need to do things with communities rather than to them.
The residence parking zone, though, really is just about raising money, isn't it, for the council? That's what I thought it was.
No, it doesn't.
No, Martin?
It's meant to be revenue neutral. The actual costs of the permits and any fines are fed back into managing it, because you get better managed parking, and then any surplus, if there is a modest surplus, because it shouldn't lose money, would go into local transport schemes. I mean, that's whether or not you like the scheme, it's meant to be revenue neutral.
Although that's not necessarily true. Because at the moment there's £500,000 surplus in the resident parking schemes. It is a revenue raising exercise. We already knew from the debates that took place during the budget that it is a form of taxation. The money cannot be reapplied to transport, but there will be huge and vast quantities of money made as a consequence of the revenue from these schemes. Now, I'm not opposed to them, but I'm not saying that they have been done or implemented in the correct way with the consultation of the people who are going to be affected by them. And today, I'm still getting complaints from residents in my ward about the double yellow lines that have gone across their driveways, etc., that they never asked for, car spaces being taken away where once there were cars, for no reason. By the way, these spaces have been taken away. It's not made the road any safer, taking away those car spaces. So, you know, it is a cash cow, and that is what everybody feared.
Getting back to the traffic congestion, though, do you believe that report saying traffic's easing and getting better? And is this metro bus going to do anything to help it?
I think traffic has congestion in the city has eased for one very good reason. You know, all the major works on the water by the water company have come to an end, so all the roads that were dug up are now usable again. And, you know, under the last administration, we implemented a policy whereby all the utility companies should be joined up so that if they're going to both be digging up the same part of the road, they do it at the same time. You know, and as a consequence of that, with there's more efficiency and greater fluidity and flexibility over the works that take place on our highways, and thus, consequently, less interruption to the user on the road, be they bike, car, bus, whatever. And yeah, congestion should ease. But understand, Tony, congestion and traffic numbers were falling from 2010 onwards. This is not a recent trend. Congestion has eased over the last 5 years.
But it's not the
city.
End of the roadworks, I can tell you that, because Britain's potholes will cost £12 billion to fix, and it's going to take 13 years, according to the Daily Mirror a few weeks ago. So it's not the end of that. I'd ask you also about this, the Metro bus. This is going to be costing something like £90 million public money, some of it local, some of it national. Is it a good idea?
£200 million.
Who is it?
It's £200 million. The whole scheme is £200 million. Bristol has a problem. The mayor put residence parking as his main priority. His main priority should have been sorting out public transport. Public transport in this provision in this city is parlous, and that's why, as the chair of the Place Scrutiny Commission, I had the first a public inquiry day where we looked at the approach for an integrated transport system in the city, and we explored all the various options as to exactly how that means. And with devolved powers, you now have the opportunity for combined authorities where you can franchise out the bus contracts and actually contract them to deliver the service that your residents and your citizens of your city need and require. And those options, those bus quality contracts, etc., are what we should be pursuing here in the city as
so
a priority
this,
to get it right.
Bus.
And the Metro bus will help, but I personally am on the record as not approving or agreeing with the M32 corridor, because I think that was a disastrous design. But we have to move forward now.
What's your prediction? I'm going to ask the others this as well. What's your prediction? Is it actually going to make any real difference?
It would be unfair of me to say that I lack any confidence where the highways team are concerned, but I do have concerns over certain aspects of the design.
Okay, hit back. Metro bus, do you think this is going to be in the next few years when it finally arrives? Is it going to make any real difference? Is it money well spent?
Well, it's going to make some difference, both negatively and positively, I'm afraid, because there is a negative impact that arises from this. Yes, there will be some positive consequences of it, but again, you know, agreeing with Christian here on this, the design.
What's wrong with the design?
Well, we all witnessed in the press the Blue Finger land that was going to be destroyed, the bridge going over the M32, the lack of park and ride provision at the top of the M32. I mean, the list is endless. What they're going to be doing to the centre of the city, I don't think people really understand what's going to be happening on Baldwin Street, the promenade in the centre there, the Cenotaph. You know, there are some significant changes coming. And by the way, that congestion story about it going down, look forward now to it going back up as they implement Metrobus.
Yeah, we've got to live through a really sort of difficult and ugly period for Bristol. But at the end of that, there may be some light.
Yeah.
Martin, what's your thoughts about Metrobus?
Well, I'm not impressed with the scheme that came forward. It's another example of central government control forcing local government to pursue one carrot of funding and then changing the rules at various stages and then saying basically take it or leave it. So we take the scheme they end up offering us, and then we pick up any surplus in the bill. It's a fixed offer that they're making, so Bristol will predominantly pick up all the overruns and so on. We're getting a very bodged scheme because basically it's sort of pursuing funding rather than pursuing common sense, and it will actually damage potentially bus services in my ward, Redland Ward, Gloucester Road, because people will use something that's available. They will use a scheme that might be a little bit faster, and what that could do is undermine the high street bus services running down Gloucester Road and elsewhere, and certainly in the centre. I was appalled to see the pavements being taken away there, and in Bedminster as well, chopping the centre into three parts, putting a new road through the middle of it, which is the space public, the public assemble and meet each other in our city centre. So it's a very bodged scheme. I wasn't impressed. And having been on the planning committee that actually was briefed and taken to visit the site after a fashion, I was actually really disappointed in the confusion and the lack of clear information and the lack of exposition exposition of all the details of the scheme, and basically we're getting a very bodged offering, and it isn't the one anyone would have actually designed if they'd had any common sense, well, sadly. And it's very expensive, and we don't even know all the final costs or necessarily the operator or the quality of the buses.
But if I could just jump in, sorry to interrupt you, Martin, because I think we're on accord on this in many respects. The mayor could have actually looked at the scheme and redesigned certain aspects of it to actually accommodate the concerns of people here in the city. He managed to do it by rerouting the bus from behind the M shed onto Clarence Road and Prince's Street.
And then he stopped.
And then he stopped any other design after that.
Which was disappointing.
You know, he created a huge delay, which has cost us, the taxpayer here in Bristol, money as a consequence of those delays. But looking at the M32 corridor, looking at the bridge, looking at the lack of park and ride, didn't bother. He could have. This is the man who's telling us he's got influence in government. He could have gone there. And my understanding is from ministers up there that he could have actually gone back with different designs. And we could have still had the money, but we could have had a different scheme.
General election, the right to buy pledge will face legal challenges, a housing association warns. Now, this is part of the Conservative Party manifesto, as revealed, selling off council houses and housing association homes as the renewal of Margaret Thatcher's right to buy scheme. Hitback, is this a good idea?
No, it's definitely not a good idea. I'm incredibly uncomfortable with this. We need a good supply of council houses and social housing, because that need is there and that need will always be there. And to dip into this and introduce this scheme, which obviously doesn't work because we are not building houses as quickly as people are buying into this this scheme of buy to let. So we're having the housing crisis is being made far worse by this.
I mean, people who can afford to buy their own council house will say, well, it works for me.
Well, I'm sure it does work for them, but the point of being in politics and being in governance is the ability to look at things from a bird's eye point of view, and what's right for one individual that chooses to practice radical individualism might be one thing, but as a councillor, as a politician, you've got to be able to look at that individual's actions and change that if then it's going to have a negative impact on everyone else.
Martin Fodor, what's your thoughts about this announcement this week?
I think it's severely misguided. Basically, we need more social housing. There's no guarantee there will be more. I mean, the Green Party's committed to 500,000 more social rented homes, because that's actually where the need is.
Well, if we're building more social housing, surely the existing stock, we could be selling that.
I'm not convinced there will be. I mean, selling off the most saleable houses with a subsidy doesn't do anything to the need to invest and repair and add to affordable and social housing. And we do know a lot of ex-council houses have turned themselves into private lets by being bought up by landlords. Now, that's hardly making homes available on a long term to people who need them. And this could be, you know, replicated with selling off housing association homes. So, no, we'd rather actually build social homes where they're needed for people.
Christian Martin, what are your thoughts about the buy-to-let business?
I think it's...
right-to-buy.
Right-to-buy, yeah.
It's almost the same thing, isn't it, in some
way? I think it's certainly got echoes of Thatcher's revolution, and we all know how that turned out. You know, no new houses were built as a consequence of the revenues that were earned. But let's not forget, deep discounts were given at the time, and deep discounts are being offered again now. You know, the implication of that is pretty clear to a lot of people, I think. You know, I prefer any policy, including my own party's policy, of building more houses, more affordable social housing. And we've made a commitment to 300,000, but we've also got a policy of rent to own, and we've also got a policy where we're going to actually lend young people who are stuck at home the opportunity to borrow money from the government to pay for their deposit, so they can have the independence and the integrity and the pride to go and rent a property and move away from home and start to lead their lives.
It's a bit unfair for me to ask you this, because we've got back from the Labour Party and Martin from the Greens, who haven't been part of the existing government, but they haven't been building anywhere near enough homes, have they? And you've been in coalition with the present government.
Yeah, and goodness knows we've struggled to get more houses built. You saw at the height of the crisis, house building plummeted because the banks held us all in hock, you know, and then the government started to release money to the banks and slowly the building industry picked up. But when it comes to social housing, you know, I agree with the idea that the government have said that we need to look at brownfield sites and how we could utilise those. I don't necessarily have a problem with looking at the larger properties that we've got that sit idle, that are owned by the government or local authorities, and how we can actually utilise those and bring them into use for social housing or low-cost housing for people on low incomes. I mean, these are all good ideas. And actually, you know, thankfully that debate is now happening.
Well,
I think the rent to own, I think the loans to help you rent your property to get out of your parents' home, they're good policies and they're stepping the
right
direction.
But why hasn't Nick Clegg been implementing these things through the coalition government that you're part of?
Well, we have been pushing at these things. You know, what makes you say that we haven't? You know,
I haven't seen public buildings being turned over for use for social housing. I haven't seen any of that.
Well, of course it's happening. It's happening up and down the country, you know, but the process that takes has to start with the evaluation of exactly where and how and who owns those properties. We've had all of that over the arena site here in Bristol. You know, we're going to build 300 homes there, apparently. But there was a long negotiation. You've seen how long it's been taking to actually buy that land off the HCA in order to then have that land on which we can build.
You've mentioned the arena. Is it a good idea? Is it a good way to spend our money? Okay, I'm going to hopefully get the figure right this time, which I got wrong on the Metro bus, which is 90 million apparently it's going to cost. The obvious question is, why is the City Council paying for this when surely if it's a viable proposition, a private developer might do it?
Well, I think we've had this conversation before, and I know from our own attempts to scrutinise the costs of the arena at the council that we've been hitting our heads against a brick wall because we're not utterly convinced that we're getting the correct answers on exactly how much it will cost us as a city. 91 is the figure that's banded around, but you know, last calculations on the back of an envelope that we did, look, you know, it's gone in excess of 110 million already, and indeed the director of place told us that they really don't know the true cost of the arena until they've dug that first hole on that piece of land and they figured out whether they can actually build on it. So, you know, is it a good thing for Bristol? I've never been opposed to an arena. I think it is a good thing for Bristol. We need to grow as a city, and a cultural centre like that provides that opportunity. However, let us consider, though, that it is a millstone around our neck as a mortgage until we know exactly how we're going to pay for it. And, of course, there's no parking provision there, so there's no revenue being earned from parking, which could have actually underpinned it. And I worked out on the back of an envelope again the other day that there's a potential for us to have earned, if there are events there every week at the arena, you know, upwards of over £1 million a year in revenue. £1 million in revenue provides a hell of a lot of borrowing for us, prudential borrowing, that we could put into other capital projects here in the city, frontline services.
If it's such a great idea, why isn't a private developer doing it?
Why isn't a private you'll have to ask the mayor that. This is his policy. We don't know all the details. All we know is that the operator is going to put up a certain certain amount of money in the form of rent, but the city can't stultify and sit still and not compete with other cities. We need you know, something like this to galvanise us, but we need to know how we're going to pay for it.
Okay, Hibak, what's your thoughts about this £91 million, £110 million, however much it's going to cost arena? Is this a good way to spend some of our council tax money?
Okay, I'll come back to the arena point, but I just wanted to go back to the point about the housing crisis. It is a housing crisis, and I've reached the conclusion that it's a housing crisis because we're completely dealing with this in the wrong way. Talking about private developers, this government has introduced the ability for business offices to be turned into residential properties. The local authority is approving these quite often, and unfortunately, the result that it's happening that it is having is. The Fleece, for example, has launched a very big campaign in order to stop this private developer developing these blocks of flats opposite the Fleece and turning it into residential property.
I mean, isn't it inevitable that if buildings are empty for a long time, that they're not viable as commercial property or offices, well, that at some point they're going to have to be redeveloped?
Well, I'm interested in tackling the housing crisis and making sure that vulnerable people are not homeless. I'm not interested in rich people from London coming into the centre of Bristol and buying highly overpriced flats. To me, that's not the housing crisis I'm trying to deal with, or that Labour Party is trying to deal with. This is about need. Coming back to the arena, I think it's a good idea. I think it's something that will greatly enhance Bristol's offer to the world. But, to me, it's a symbol of further inequality. It's a symbol of further segregation, socioeconomic segregation. We have Cabot Circus right on the doorstep of Lawrence Hill, the ward that I represent. And within Lawrence Hill, we have St. Jude's, which is an incredibly poor area within the top 10% of lower super output areas. And how many people do you think that live in St. Jude's actually have jobs in Cabot Circus?
None. I'm guessing. I mean, you're
correct.
Making a point.
Correct.
There.
Correct. So if we're going to have this arena and we're going to have it near Lawrence Hill in an area that's economically challenged and where we have failing schools and high levels of unemployment, we mustn't repeat another Cabot Circus.
Okay, on to another subject, and there are 400 feared dead this week. In fact, now it's been reported they are dead after a migrant boat capsized in the Mediterranean. Italy's Coast Guard has rescued 144, though, from a ship off of Libya, but survivors tell Save the Children that hundreds were on board. This is Al Jazeera reporting a couple of days ago. Now, there's obviously a very serious problem with people desperately trying to get out from Syria and Libya. I'll ask you first on this one, Martin.
Okay.
Doesn't Britain bear some responsibility for this, having supplied a lot of these rebels that then eventually turned into ISIS and were doing all sorts of nasty stuff too in Libya, really destabilising the country? And now the people are trying to get out. Many of them are dying on the way across the Mediterranean.
Yeah, well, our country certainly has a lot of responsibility for the meddling and the sort of adventures in various other countries, usually ones that seem to have oil, from my experience. There's a bit less enthusiasm where there aren't resources we seem to be after. But people migrate for many, many reasons. I'm from a migrant family. I'm from a refugee family myself. And
where are you
people,
from?
All my relatives are from other countries. My father was escaped the Holocaust. My mother's family were refugees as well from what was going on in the pogroms in the past in Russia and Ukraine.
So I
wouldn't exist if people hadn't been able to migrate, and my family obviously have worked and contributed all their lives since then. But what I'm saying is people move for many reasons, and for instance, Our aid program can make things better where people are, and they're far less likely to then want to move. What we do have is a phenomenon where pretty well qualified people, or people with some savings, some resources, actually tend to be the ones who move, or people have to flee war and violence and terror and all sorts of awful things.
So how do we stop this happening? I mean, you're talking about a national level here.
We need to support people who actually are fleeing war and attacks and so on. But we also have to promote development where people are in their communities.
No, I'm talking really more about foreign policy. How do we stop the British Ministry of Defence and British forces getting involved in creating these conflicts in the first place, as they've done in Libya and Syria?
Various governments have started wars, such as the Iraq War, started by Tony Blair, among others, and sort of kind of war in contributing to fighting in Libya and so on.
So what are the Greens going to do to stop that?
Well, we think military forces are there for defence, to actually protect people, and they're not there to interfere in other countries. So I don't think we would necessarily be starting those wars, frankly.
My question, can I ask a question?
Just a moment. Then the point being, we actually do have to do something to support people once they are fleeing, and letting them drown at sea is utterly, utterly horrific.
My question to you would be, where does the Green Party draw the line when it comes to Britain's foreign policy? I mean, hypothetically speaking, if you were the overall majority party that was running this country, what would your foreign policy be? Would it be, well, we're simply going to erase Britain's history of involvement in all these countries all around the world, and unless we're being benevolent, and we are going exactly as I said, unless we're being benevolent, we're choosing not to get involved in other people's countries. How do you square that circle?
Yeah. Well, I said not getting involved in military adventures and wars.
Well, no,
I did say
how would you get involved?
It's really important to contribute to development. And we have all sorts of links with all sorts of countries, where a lot of wealth of our city of Bristol comes from because of our previous colonial or other involvement. And I would like to see us contributing to development in those communities.
My question is, when there are people being massacred in the world, I think this is an important point. He's had a chance to answer it, right or wrong.
But what about the point Martin's making there about Tony Blair, the previous Labour government, going into Iraq? Was that the right thing to do?
It's unfortunate that you've asked me that question. I was on the streets with millions of British people marching against the Iraq war. And on top of that, I personally came to this country as a two-year-old refugee from Somalia with my father, with nothing but the clothes on our back. So, no, I did not support the war in Iraq. And I perhaps more acutely than any of you three understand the pain of going through that and what that causes a family and the post-traumatic stress disorder that goes with seeing some of those horrific things. So when I say to you I was against the Iraq war, I'm not coming at this from a textbook point of view or because it's politically fashionable to bash Tony Blair. I'm coming at this because I understand it far more than you do. So no, I don't. But coming back to the point that I was making, I think the Green Party really needs to answer this question. There are cruel, horrible people in the world, such as ISIS, that are on a daily basis slaughtering innocent people, whether that's based on religious hatred or any other form of prejudice that they choose. They are doing this, right? Britain has a responsibility in the world. Now, what I want to know is, hypothetically speaking, if the Green Party was leading this country, what would its policy be? How do you resolve some of those issues in the world?
But Martin's already had a chance to answer that.
I would like to add that the answer wasn't very clear. Contributing to peacekeeping and contributing to things that resolve conflict is far more important than bombing people indiscriminately, which is what's been.
I'm not advocating for that. Can you have your response to
this business of 400 people dying this week on the way across the Mediterranean from countries where Britain has been intervening in Iraq and Libya?
I don't think any amongst us haven't been moved and affected by the scenes that we've seen on the news with regard to these poor devils who are trying to make it across the Mediterranean. I'm not sure what the answer is because we certainly don't have the resource to go down there and help them flee as much as one would like to. We can't send a fleet of boats.
But my point was, my point that I was going to make was that that navy cannot control the entire coastline
of Northern Africa. You know, it can only patrol certain aspects of it.
But why did the government want to end the patrols that could have helped? But it's not just
the responsibility either of the British government. who are doing something. But Martin, you know, you make these comments, but you've not actually said how you would resolve ISIS crisis. No. I mean, your party, didn't your party want it to make it legal for everyone to actually be able to belong to ISIS?
What did that mean? We said that if
People are entitled to views. That doesn't mean you make terrorism legal. Lots of people have all sorts of views.
Yeah, we had a discussion about this last week, which is there's every difference in the world between having a view, but the point is the people that are fleeing these war-torn countries,
you would make it okay
countries
for
that
people
have been
to
turned
be members.
Upside down by internal conflict and ISIS and various other things. They have created a real issue, and we know and we can conjecture where part of the roots of this has come from. But I'm asking you, Martin, how are the Green Party going to help in this situation? How are they going to solve the problem? How are they going to solve the threat of ISIS? Because I heard you say we want to get rid of Trident and scrap the $100 billion. That's what you said.
I think we've had enough. But the point is, Martin, how is he going to defend Trident?
Not really helpful in terms of education in communities in North Africa.
But Tony, there is a suggestion that he has made that we can all sit around a campfire, hold hands and sing kumbaya. And that's going to solve the world's problems. It is not going to solve the world's problems by having us all sit down and have a bit of resolution. I'm not being ridiculous at all.
Can we please move the discussion on to talk about the results of some of this here in Britain, which is a big increase in migrants and what's to be done about it? First of all, possibly, I'd like to hear from you all whether you think the big increase in migration is a problem, and secondly, whether this has undermined a work that's been being done for literally hundreds of years by trade unions to keep up paying conditions. Maybe you first, Ibak.
Well, first of all, I have to say I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed that we in Britain haven't taken on more Syrian refugees. You know, we are a powerful country. It might not feel like it at the moment, but in the grand scheme of things, we are actually quite an influential, quite a prosperous country.
Well, sixth richest country in the world.
Precisely. And coming with that title of being the sixth richest, it comes a degree of responsibility, and we're falling far behind, and it's shameful. If we're able to bomb countries, we should also be able to help countries. So,
do you see a difference between refugees and economic migrants?
Well, yes, of course there's a difference.
So how should we deal with the two differently, or or should we have an open door policy effectively, from the whole of Europe, migrants coming from all over Eastern Europe, for example?
Look, I'm in favour of being in the European Union. I'm in favour of that. I'm in favour of the free movement of people and trade. We're part of a greater European Union, European family, and that makes us better and it makes us stronger, and I'm proud of that. Economic migrants and refugees and asylum seekers, it's a completely different ballgame. You cannot compare apples and oranges. We have a moral duty to look after the world's refugees. It's embarrassing that we're not, and we should. When it comes to economic migrants, Ed Miliband has, in the last few weeks, I'm sure everyone has seen, laid out Labour's clear vision and clear plan for dealing with economic migrants.
Which is
quite simply that those people we need to come along to the UK and work in this country, we need to respect them, we need to pay them a fair wage, so on and so forth. We should be supporting our European brothers who come from Romania, who come from Poland, who come here to try and work, and we should also be supporting them, making sure that they're not exploited, which they are currently exploited. This completely false argument which has been stoked up by the Daily Mail between the poor British people and economic migrants who are also poor is completely nonsensical. It's completely nonsensical. We should be protecting economic migrants, making sure they're not being exploited, making sure that they also, in turn, are not undercutting the wages of British people who are also trying to get some of those similar jobs. But at the same time, we have to appreciate that as a country, we would not be able to function without immigrants.
Christian Martin, in Germany, one of the things they do is they say you can't actually even apply for a job. You're not legally allowed to work in Germany unless you can speak German and write German up to a decent standard.
Is that a fact?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, we do
that's a fact or not.
Different countries in Europe do things differently.
Yeah,
well, perhaps they invest in people.
Yeah,
we don't invest in ESOL classes. We've cut.
Yeah.
We've had
that's right,
cuts.
This government's cut.
Can I finish? We
yeah.
have cut since 2000. We are sitting right now in the Beacon Centre, which is an adult learning centre in the Eastern Ward, which back in 2009 had up to 400 people, men and women, refugees and skilled migrant labour, individuals coming in through these doors and learning to speak English, okay? And those that could afford it were making a contribution. Those that could not afford it, they were being provided with these classes for free. So when we want to moan about immigrants, whether they're asylum seekers or whether they're migrants not speaking English, maybe we should invest in their ability to speak English. Maybe other European countries are investing in people's ability to speak the language.
I'm not sure the Germans would actually teach you. They'll say you just can't apply for a job unless you know. Anyway, Christian, what are your thoughts from
sure
the Liberal Democrats?
There's a lot that Hipak has said that, you know, I agree with. This country needs immigrants. A large section of the immigrant workforce are paying for the pensions of those UKIP supporters that want to vote them out of the country.
What about the lowering of paying conditions that this has brought about over, you know, many years now?
That's not the fault of immigrants.
No.
That's the fault of companies that go to Europe and invite people over.
Christian, I'm asking you, how do you deal with the lowering of paying conditions?
We've got
a lot more jobs, but they're far less paid, and we've got loads more people having to claim benefits.
You have to tackle that inequality
in
of
full-time
pay.
Work and claiming benefits now.
And that has to be tackled, it has to be policed, and it has to be stopped. I mean, I have no objection to that whatsoever. It makes absolute sense. But, you know, Martin God bless him, you know, keeps referring to the cuts. You know, the cuts have caused all these problems.
I'd like it if you could actually just answer the point about lowering pay conditions. Just hang on, Martin. I'm trying to get Christian to answer this question about lowering of paying conditions, an increase in number of jobs, but a lowering of quality of jobs, and so many more people actually now being having to claim benefits whilst on full-time jobs.
The government has put up the minimum wage. So I don't know what more you want me to add to that. The government has put up a minimum wage. Companies that are exploiting workers need to be stopped. Companies that are exploiting immigrant workers to this country and offering them and paying them less need to be stopped and prosecuted. It's as simple as that. We have a minimum wage. It is enshrined in law. That is what should be paid.
Martin Fodor from the Greens. Do you see the increase in migrants over the last 7-8 years particularly as a problem since more people have been coming from the EU? And because ultimately what it's doing is it's been forcing down wages in this country as a whole.
Well we have a single market for both capital and for people, and you can't have one without the other as far as I'm concerned. So people can move and capital can move, and if the jobs are here, then people will follow the jobs. Now, the low pay that the government currently subsidises by topping up people's wages with benefits isn't very attractive, and that's why the Green Party has been committed to the living wage and wants it at £10 an hour by 2020, which is going to help everyone who's on low pay. Now, also, the current government has cut language class. I agree with Hibak on that. And that's pretty shameful, frankly, because you then complain people can't speak the language. You're running our NHS and all sorts of other vital public services.
Ought to mention that it's not just the UKIP, Conservatives, Lib Dems, Greens and Labour that are standing in these elections. It's also the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, Independence for Bristol, Left Unity, and also a party, I think it's only one person standing from that party, that's Vapors in Power, whatever they are, and English Democrats and the British National Party are also standing in these local elections. And one of the independents it's not Independence for Bristol, but it's Independence for North Somerset, is also a new party which has arrived because of what they call corruption down in North Somerset. Things like the selling off of the Winter Gardens for £1, the selling off of the college for £1, the selling off of Knightstone Island for £1 a year lease, and the complete failure to renovate the Tropicana, which is a place down there where people used to be able to go and swim. It was owned and controlled by the council, and it was there even when the tide was out in Western Super Mud. So we're going to hear now from someone from Derek Mead from Independence for North Somerset.
Derek Mead, I'm a Western person, always lived mainly around North Wirral. We're farmers, Puxton Park, and we're standing really because we believe that Western needs some fresh ideas and fresh faces on the council. We have a marvellous town here, plenty of beach and a motorway junction, a mainline station, but we have 45,000 people a day going out of Western looking for jobs, which is just not good enough.
Now, I know one of the things that brought people together was the Tropicana. Tell us how that's unfolded over the years and what part that's played in bringing people together to actually do something different in Western.
It's an absolute disgrace. The Tropicana, or the old pool as it was commonly known, should never have shut in the first place. Like I said, we got plenty of lovely beach, but unfortunately the tide goes out twice a day and we have not got constant water. And when Henry Butt built it in 37, it was very, very popular. I used to spend a lot of time in there as a teenager and a young person. And people that's come to Western, we have got to increase the attractions and the stayability in Western so that they spend more.
But it's symptomatic, isn't it, of the way that the council in Western has been managing public assets. There are others too. Knightstone Island, for example, sold off cheap. Can you just take us through some of the things that have been going on over the last few years, where I think it's the college as well site was also sold. Now we've got the Winter Gardens up for sale. These things are going for almost nothing, these prices.
Well, I think it's an absolute disgrace, personally, that North Somerset are selling off major assets. Their asset management is a disgrace. And the Tropicana, I got involved with it, very much supported by John Penrose, suggested that a group of us got together and turn it into a charitable trust. opens the door for lottery money, coastal money, etc. And the council have done everything they possibly can to stop that.
So how has this come about, where you've got a council that seems to actually be working against the interests of the town, selling off public assets extremely cheap? I mean, there must be questions about, you know, is this white-collar crime? Because this is actually much more valuable than the prices they're selling these things off for. And they are supposed to be stewarding these things for the general public.
Well, that is why I believe, and a lot of us believe within this town, that we want some new people on the council that really love the town and really want to get the assets for the use of the people of Weston-super-Mare. We're calling ourselves North Somerset First Independent Group. We're actually putting up 18 candidates, and there is a lot of other independents within the county. I think altogether, independent-wise, there is 34.
But why didn't you just sort of join one of the other parties, maybe even one of the new parties like the Greens or UKIP, and go along with them?
I am a Conservative, but unfortunately, and I was a Vice President of the Weston-super-Mare Conservatives and quite a large contributor towards them, but unfortunately there's a few comedians in there that, they moved me into a position where I resigned. I believe that local government should be independent. When it comes to national politics, you join up with your party. But I classify myself as definitely a light blue Conservative. I think one of the problems with the Conservatives is that there's a lot of them there that think they've got a divine right to rule, but you've got to earn the right to rule.
Well, definitely wise words there from Derek Mead. You have no divine right to rule from the Bullingdon Club or anywhere else. You've got to earn the right, and that's what they're going to be doing at the forthcoming local and general elections. I'm joined around the table by Hibak Jama from the Labour Party locally here, Christian Martin from the Liberal Democrats, and Martin Fodor from the Green Party. And we're going to finish on a quick question from about the National Health Service, because the health service is facing, we hear this week, a substantial financial problem which politicians are ignoring in the election campaign. The former head of the service said to David Nicholson, retired last year, and he told the BBC the NHS in England was accruing large deficits which would become crystal clear later this year. Pretty worrying stuff. Christian Martin, what are we going to do about this?
Well, we're going to do exactly what the Liberal Democrats have said they're going to do. We're going to put £8 billion into the NHS over the next Parliament. And the IFS have come out and supported the fact that we've made that pledge, along with the £3.5 billion that we said we're going to put into mental health. You know, two incredibly important policies, two incredibly large sums of money that are going to support the NHS.
Martin Fodor from the Greens, apparently there's an enormous great financial hole, possibly £8 billion, something like that, in the National Health Service. How are we going to deal with
that? Yes, I heard about that. Well, for a start, at the moment, £18 million a day is being put into the hands of private companies from the